last week. We got up to verse 37. And so it's a long chapter, this one, over 80 verses. And we're going to the remaining half of chapter 8. So I'll just read the summary of the chapter. So this is an overview of chapter 8. Maitreya Muni tells Vidura about the Brahmachari sons of Brahma, his demoniac children, and the descendants of Svayambhuva Manu, including Priyavrata and Uttanapada, whose wife Saniti had a son called Dhruva. So we heard about the Brahmachari sons of Brahma. He also had some demoniac children, which we had a little discussion on. And then other sons of Brahma, particularly Svayambhuva Manu, and his sons, Priyavrata and Uttanapada, whose wife Saniti had a son called Dhruva. And now, having been prevented by his wife, by his envious stepmother, Suruchi. Suruchi, what do you derive from that name if someone is called Suruchi? You think? Very beautiful form. Perhaps, someone whose form is exceptionally beautiful. Perhaps that is why Uttanapada was particularly attracted to Suruchi. And Suniti, someone who's very intelligent, really. So exceptional logic and reasoning and intelligence, right? So he's perhaps more attracted to the beauty than the intelligence of them. Uttanapada, he had two wives, Suruchi, who was his second wife, and Saniti, who was his first wife, but he was more attached to his second wife, Suruchi. So, now Dhruva, he was prevented by his stepmother Suruchi from climbing onto his father's lap, and he felt insulted, and he left the palace. He saw his mother, Saniti, who advised him to go to the forest to find the Supreme Personality of Godhead and engage in his service in order to mitigate his distress. And she was, in fact, repeating a similar instruction that his envious stepmother Suruchi had given him, but she had given him that instruction in an envious mood, as if, basically that's what you'd have to do to sit on the king's lap, and that's never going to happen. She was sort of, giving in that mood. But Suniti, good instruction there. Perhaps you should follow it. Now, Narada, who, by the prompting of the Lord, he heard this, and he was struck with wonder on hearing Dhruva's activities, and he went there and tested his resolve by suggesting that the path Dhruva had chosen is too difficult and that he should wait until he's grown up. Narada also advised Dhruva to be satisfied in whatever condition he finds himself. Dhruva responds by admitting his inability to follow Narada's instructions because of a lack of brahminical humility and the desire to occupy a position more exalted than achieved by any of his ancestors. Of course, that means even Brahma. So he wants a realm greater than any demigod. Narada becomes compassionate towards Dhruva Maharaj and repeats his mother Suniti's advice to engage in devotional service to the Supreme Lord. He tells Dhruva to go to Madhavan to perform Astanga Yoga on the banks of the Jamuna with the goal of meditation, the personality of Godhead. Narada explains how the Lord is a person and describes his beautiful characteristics. He then gives Dhruva a mantra to chant and explains the paraphernalia required for worship of the Lord. On entering the forest, Dhruva strictly follows the orders of his spiritual master, Narada Muni, and thus captures the Supreme Lord. In the meantime, Narada met with Dhruva's father, King Uttanapad, to advise him of Dhruva's activities which caused the universe to tremble and disturb the demigods, who then approached the Lord for reassurance. So there are different essay questions which some of the students choose to write and be marked on. There's one of which is an essay on personal application. You've got three questions to choose from and do one essay, and then you should do also an essay on mood and mission, and an essay on preaching application. So because we're doing chapter 8, one of the essay that can be written is drawing points relevant for your own practice of Krishna consciousness from Narada Rishi's instructions. This is the question one of the personal application. The drawing points relevant for your own practice of Krishna consciousness from Narada Rishi's instructions and Suniti's instructions to Dhruva Maharaj, and describe how by applying these points will help your practice in Krishna consciousness. So we looked at Suniti's instructions in verses 17 to 23, and we've looked at some of Narada's instructions from verses 26 to 34, and today we'll look at other instructions from verses 42 to 62. So we're going to continue that section of personal application question one. And now, other things which will come up today is in the mood and mission question for the essay, it says that we select passages from chapter 8 which reflect Prabhupada's mood and mission and discuss the relevance of these statements for ISKCON's development. So far we haven't looked at any mood and mission statements, but there are about three or four sections of this chapter today which come up which reflect on mood and mission, and we'll sort of look at that, how these apply to Prabhupada's mood and mission, which of course is our mood and mission. So in fact, the first few verses that we do, verses 38 to 40, there were statements in verse 36, and there's some in 38 to 40, which we'll sort of look at first. So, You've got your Bhagavatams and your iPads and your laptops. First, we'll have a look at the purport to verse 36. Now, we heard that Narada Muni, giving a lot of very important discussions, but if we sort of paraphrase it in a modern way, we might just say, get over it and go back home. Wait till you grow up and do something about it. That's good. Now, he said, I can't do that. I'm not just going to forget about this. He says, I was born in a Kshatriya family. My stepmother Saruchi has pierced my heart with harsh words. Therefore, your valuable instructions does not stand in my heart. So, in this purport, Srila Prabhupada describes some, aspects of Varnashram, giving instruction according to different varnas, which, should be applied in ISKCON. Now, in the second paragraph, it explains down the bottom, Dhruva frankly admitted that he was lacking in brahminical humility and was therefore unable to accept the philosophy of Narada Muni. So he was saying he lacked that brahminical humility. They say that, a brahmana or a brahmani will forgive practically immediately. A Kshatriya, it's very difficult for them to forgive, but they will forgive. But after some, a little bit more time. Maybe they want to see a bit of, revenge, repentance. The Vaishyas, they will find it even more difficult to forgive, and it will take them longer. And the Sudras, they'll not forgive. As time goes past. So, he's saying, you expect me to, get over this like a Brahmana would. You just forgive, move on. I've got the Kshatriya spirit, that's not going to happen. and which is interesting because I know that, whenever some extremely difficult circumstances arise in my life as a devotee, the most common thing that you will hear, generally the devotees just tolerate. Just tolerate it, like that. And of course, because I'm a Brahmana, I have to practice that. But, it just doesn't apply. You can't just say that to everyone, You can't just tell everyone every time something, extremely difficult happens. You just got to tolerate. You just can't apply that everyone from every level of devotee, right to the new beginner, I'll just tolerate, that's it. Okay, done. Yeah, tolerate. Oh, it's gone. That sort of instruction is not very satisfying for some. Even within our group, they actually need a little bit more. Something. Some devotees will be extremely insulted if you said that to them. I'll just tolerate. I'm thinking, you've got no idea what I'm going through. I'm just tolerate. That's the most ridiculous instruction you could possibly give. Mm-hmm. The statements of Dhruva Maharaj indicate that unless a child is trained according to his tendency, there is no possibility of his developing his particular spirit. It was the duty of the spiritual master or teacher to observe the psychological movement of a particular boy, you know, or girl, of course, and train him in a particular occupational duty. Dhruva Maharaj, having already been trained in the Kshatriya spirit, would not accept the Brahminical philosophy. Now, Prabhupada, interesting the way that Prabhupada says that it's the duty of the spiritual master or teacher. So it's not just the guru. Teacher means that there are many shiksha gurus. It's not just one's diksha guru will observe. You know, within the community there are many people who guide that particular, you know, person, child. They're also observing. And they also, as it discussed, they're meant to observe the psychological movement of a particular and thus train them. Because these are, you know, various things which need to be applied within ISKCON. Actually, in many cases, what I've seen is that, you know, in many temples that I've been in, that those who actually teach the young students who come to Krishna consciousness have no say whatsoever, even though they're observing regularly their particular spirit. They have no say whatsoever in how to train that particular person. It's usually left up to either the temple president or the Diksha Guru or something like that. Which, you know, according to what with the seminar that Sureshra was just giving on Srila Prabhupada's position, it's sort of another instance where we have to be careful in our movement of one person taking an absolute authority in a crucial matter. You know, this is a sort of discussion amongst various teachers, gurus, people who are guiding a person at various stages in very significant ways. It's not really within our philosophy generally that one person just sometimes without really being in the position to observe the person, but just because they're in a position of absolute authority, may actually just then say, well, this person will do this, this person will do that, like that. You know, we really want our society to be one where persons who are teaching, training, and who have, between the parents, you know, the teachers, the gurus, both Shiksha and Diksha, all observing and, coming to a decision through proper discussion, what is for the benefit of, particular people who come to Krishna consciousness, or people who are born in Krishna consciousness, or, you know, like that. Any comments on that?
Within the ISKCON structure, Srila Prabhupada emphasized mainly on the Brahminical culture, which is one of the ashram of our ashram. The other three ashram, we know that everyone is born Shudra, so we leave the Shudra far. Between the Kshatriya and the Vaishya community, he did not really, Srila Prabhupada, segregate between the two. He treated the other one as one group, and he wanted all of us to rise to the Brahminical level, isn't it?
No. No.
Did he make any demarcation between the Kshatriya and the Vaishya? Delineation between the
two? Yeah, he did.
Well,
for instance, one time, there was, when he was discussing about different leaders, he was discussing how some of the, and there was one or two in particular in those days, there were one or two of his disciples who went into politics, and he considered that they had a Kshatriya spirit, and that, he discussed them in terms of having that Kshatriya spirit by going into politics and wanting to lead. Because all of that, politics, diplomacy, that's all part of Kshatriya life. And he discussed that if need be, they would also have to fight. When he was explaining this, one of the Indian persons in the audience said, so they're not going to be trained to fight. They're not actually going to fight. They're not real Kshatriyas, are they? He said, yes, no, we will train them. We will train them to fight. All these things will come. But what Prabhupada understood was this. There's no use saying, set up to train Kshatriyas and Vaishyas and what have you, if you don't have Brahmanas, because Brahmanas are the ones who train them all. You have to set up the Brahminical community first. There's no Brahmanas. He went to Africa, there's no Brahmanas. He went to Russia, there's no Brahmanas. He had to first establish the Brahmanas. He travelled the world, over what, 12 years, 14 times. And within that time, he particularly concentrated upon training the Brahmanas. 12 years is not a long time to take someone off the street and make them into a Brahmana who's qualified to lead all of society. But he did pretty much that. Now, once those Brahmanas were established, they would do the rest. But he did discuss it. But, first you have to establish the temples and establish the Brahminical community. Otherwise, where's the question of training anyone else?
How could a Brahmana lead a society? Because he should have a Kshatriya spirit. He doesn't have leadership.
But a Kshatriya cannot lead without guidance from a Brahmana. Kshatriya means that they take guidance from Brahmanas and lead. So if you train someone as a Kshatriya and there's no Brahmanas to guide them, how can they act as a Kshatriya?
I understand. You need Brahmanas. The Brahmana may not necessarily can lead a society.
Yes, they do. They do. Brahmanas, actually the whole country or the world belongs to the Brahmanas. They are the head. This is the head. What you're saying is that the head doesn't guide the body. The head does guide the body. The Brahman is at the head. We did this in Canto 2. We're going backwards.
The Brahman is restricted to deity worship, and he will not be really interested in leading a society or something. I'm talking technically,
No, they do.
They can lead
technically.
Kshatriya
is like the arms. They have executive function, and they will enforce that executive function. But the arms cannot, no matter how powerful or how technical or expertise the arms are, without the brain, they cannot lead themselves. Imagine a body without a head.
Although all are important, head is the most important. Yes. Without that we can't function. But other parts, if it's not there, at least it is okay. But head is.
Actually, one of the greatest, so-called greatest scientists in the world, basically, is the head in a wheelchair. You know, there's a body that doesn't function at all. You know, what's his name? Stephen Hawking. Stephen. He's basically a head, but he's actually one of the leading thinkers of this world. So basically, he's just a brain.
Brahmanas, then the Brahmanas can train
Kshatriyas. Yes.
And then Kshatriyas can from the Vaishya.
That's right.
The,
yeah.
If you have the Brahmanas, then other society will
follow.
That's
right. Even though Kshatriyas are ruling, the instruction is given by Brahmanas.
Yes. Yeah.
So they are ruling, but through Kshatriyas.
Yeah.
But they are Brahmanas.
The Brahmanas explain to them what are the laws that they should be enforcing. So in Kali Yuga, do they enforce the laws of the Manusamhita?
You're giving one example based on the past. But currently, is it big practice? That's my question. No one wants to take advice from a Brahmin.
I get that even in the temple. No, that actually it is the most practical, because you'll find that in every country of the world, actually throughout the whole universe, that those who are the thinkers, they are guiding the rulers.
The thinkers may not be necessarily Brahmin.
Therefore, they have those who are the thinkers need to be trained, but their natural spirit is already there. And this is what we're saying, that within any, you go to any country in the world and you'll find that these natural divisions eternally exist. There are always a class of persons who actually, they reflect and think and they have knowledge above everyone else, and they want to guide and help people by giving that knowledge. Now, in this day and age, those persons may take the roles of professors, scientists, philosophers, religionists, and what have you. But because there's no proper training for them, then instead, although their inclination is to act like a brahmana, in effect they act like sutras. So that, because they're untrained. But the tendency is there, and therefore that tendency just has to be harnessed. Therefore, when Srila Prabhupada travelled throughout the whole world, he found that those intelligent class of person were there, and they came forward to become trained as brahmanas. And
since they have the inclination of brahmana already.
Yeah.
Like you said, in India we can easily divide like brahmana kshatriya, but in the West, like you said, here also there are four varnas. But there are people who are producing like fresh produce. They are vaishya class. So like
that,
even Brahmanas are there here, just like...
Yeah, that's right, yes. The inclination is there, but until they're trained, then that spirit is just... it will just be... their good intelligence, they will just be put into... serving the sudras or the vaishyas. You see? So therefore we see that the philosophers, the religionists, the thinkers of this world, they serve the Vaishyas and the Sudras. You know, because you know, society is not properly organized. You know, to give an example that, you know, when a person wants to take some intoxication, they might want to have a cigarette. Now, the way the body is supposed to function is that the mind dictates to the body that, oh, here's a cigarette, this will kill me, and perhaps my children and so many other people will cause so much trouble, will rob me of all my money and my dignity and what have you. Therefore, I won't have it. So that's what the head should be doing. But in Kali Yuga, the head is not ruling the body. The eyes and the tongue, you know, is dictating. That the brain is saying, oh, I don't know about this, and the tongue is saying, you know, shut up, I want it. So our society is the same. That there may be some brahminical inclination or thinkers, but those who represent sense gratification are just forcing even the, you know, the brain of society just to help them have sense gratification. So therefore, you know, the person wants the intoxication of the cigarette, so then, you know, the tongue is saying, no, I want that intoxication, I want, and then it's forcing the brain. So you know, how shall we get enough money to keep that supply coming in? You know, is getting the brain that you know, or how can we hide that we're not supposed to do this? How can we do this in a way we will not be detected? So the brain is becoming the servant of the tongue. But that's, you know, and in society it is the same. That those who demand sense gratification, they're using the thinkers, the brains of society, and even the executive function of society, literally to fulfill that demand, you see. So, you know, it is an unnatural. But naturally they exist within society. You know, the thinkers, you know, the intelligent persons are there. There is always a class of intelligent persons. There is always a class of persons who rule and administrate and have a kshatriya spirit. You know, they won't back down from the challenge. They won't accept an insult, what have you. There are always a class of person who like to produce the needs of society. And then there are those who like to just serve, you know, those other three higher classes. So that is there, whether you go to a communist country, an anarchist country, you know, or anything. It is there. So Prabhupada first had to pick up the intelligent persons who had that natural inclination and train them. The spirit is already there, but now just train them. And if that is not done, if there's no brahminical trained person, they've got the natural brahminical spirit, and then they're trained. If that's not there, there's no question of having kshatriyas, vaishyas, or even sudras, you know, properly, in a proper sense. So therefore, let's have a little bit more at this purport. Now, Prabhupada goes on to say, in America, we're looking at verse 36. In America, we have practical experience of this incompatibility of the Brahminical and Kshatriya temperaments. The American boys, who have simply been trained as Sudras, are not at all fit to fight in battle. Therefore, when they are called to join the military, they refuse because they do not have the Kshatriya spirit. See? So he's noting that they don't have a Kshatriya spirit. They're being trained as Sudras. This is a cause of great dissatisfaction in society. That the boys do not have the Kshatriya spirit does not mean that they are trained in Brahminical qualities. They are trained as Sudras, and thus their frustration, they are becoming hippies. So he's saying that they don't have... He noticed that many of the boys that were coming to him, they didn't have the Kshatriya spirit. They didn't want to go to war. But he's saying, but they also obviously didn't want to become subjects, because in frustration they were becoming hippies. So that leaves either the Vaishyas or Brahmins. Now, many of them, if you become a hippie, you don't want to be a businessman either. So the natural conclusion Prabhupada understood is that they seem to have the Brahminical spirit. As soon as they enter the Krishna consciousness movement, being started in America, they are trained to meet the Brahminical qualifications, even though they have fallen to the lowest conditions of sudras. So he's noticing that they must have this spirit of Brahmins, therefore we'll train them as Brahmins. They don't want to go to war, they're not Kshatriyas. Their fathers are very wealthy persons, and they don't want to do business, they're not Vaishyas. And they're dissatisfied as sudras, as sudras, therefore they're becoming hippies. So, that leaves Brahmins. So he trained them. In other words, since the Krishna consciousness movement is open for everyone, people in general can attain the Brahminical qualifications. And this is the greatest need at the present moment, for now there are actually no Brahmanas or Kshatriyas, but only some Vaishyas, and for the most part, Sudras. This classification of society into Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Sudras is very scientific. In the human social body, the Brahmanas are considered the head. The Kshatriyas the arms, the Vaishyas the bellies, and the Sudras are the legs. At the present moment, the body has the legs and a belly, but there are no arms or head. And therefore society is topsy-turvy. It is necessary to re-establish the Brahminical qualifications in order to raise the fallen human society to the highest standard of spiritual consciousness. So, one, Prabhupada notes two things in this purport. The greatest need at the present moment, when Prabhupada was establishing Krishna consciousness, was there are no Brahmanas and Kshatriyas. Right? So he does mention both. He's not just saying no Brahmanas, but he's saying there's no Brahmanas and Kshatriyas. So there's a great need to have both. And he noted that, as he said in his purport, that many of the students who come to him didn't have the Kshatriya spirit. He trained them as Brahmanas, and that's the greatest need above everything. But that doesn't mean that Prabhupada had no... Even in this purport, he's indicating that we actually have a need to train Kshatriyas as well. But the point I made at the very beginning was that really this Krishna consciousness movement, if it actually wants to guide society properly, we have to have, trained Brahmanas who have that Brahminical spirit. They're naturally thinkers of, who guide society through knowledge. Those with that spirit should come, we find them and we train them. Those who have a Kshatriya spirit can then be, guided by the Brahmanas in their Kshatriya activities through ISKCON. Those with Vaishya tendencies may go to the farms. Another example, you asked for examples before. In our Gurukul, one time there was a Gurukul, one time still is, in Vrindavan, and one of the teachers noted, again, we're seeing, not the guru, but one of the teachers was explaining to Prabhupada, who was a guru for the whole society, that he had observed the qualities of one of the students. So you see here, it's not just the guru's job, the teacher, that this boy doesn't fit into this class. He's rowdy, he can't sit still, he can't study, he can't learn the slokas, he's just not interested. So Prabhupada said, put him in the field and let him plough and, do some farming and do something with the cows. He's obviously, we don't want to force everyone to just, attend the Gurukul and be put into some slot if they're not... if they don't have that tendency. Therefore, let them work on the farms or do business or something like that. So, that's another example where Srila Prabhupada is the very good example of this purport, where both the teacher, who was observing the boy at close hand, had a very powerful effect on, Srila Prabhupada, the ultimate authority, the two of them discussing. The discussion went back forward. The discussion went back and forward for some time. And this is what we need to see in ISKCON. And as I said, too often you don't see it in something. You need to see where those who actually have, are in the position, they're training, observing, teaching new students or, some of the children, they should have an input as to, noticing their spirit, their natural tendencies, so that they can be trained in that way. It's not some remote person who may have great authority, who's not necessarily observing them, or who makes some decision about what they should be doing. That's not how things work, but that quite often that's the way things go.
And there's no feedback.
That's right, there has to be feedback between, people who are with the new devotees or the, new students or children or the families, and help them be properly situated, a variety of different persons like that. Some may have that natural inclination. They want to do deity worship and study the shastras and teach the shastras and guide like that. Others may like doing business, and earning money for Krishna. And others like to provide some do finances or banking, that aspect of it. Some like to provide the foods and the milk products and look after the land. And some like to administrate. Some like to fight and protect. We need a few more of them around here.
Security.
There should be a proper, system where when persons come along to ISKCON, they will be observed by the correct persons and they will actually be properly situated. We don't really have that system. Right? What we have is that they sort of come along, they might ask someone in the courtyard, I've come to Krishna consciousness, I'd like to do some service around here. Oh, well, what's that?
Crowd control.
If you ask me, I need someone to help me do crowd control, or I need someone to, I'm a bit short-handed in the kitchen, and then they end up in there, they make a few friends, and that's where they stay for 10 years. It's not as if they were systematically put into some, a situation. I remember in New Zealand there was one boy, and he brahmachari, and he, very, very enthusiastic. He used to cook and do the pots and this, that, and the other, and work with somebody collecting Lakshmi and what have you. And one day there was no one to give class, and they go in to give class, and he gave this, class, just wonderful shastric ability. But it was just accidental that, he just ended up on the asana, But, we can't have a movement like that where people are just accidentally ending up And then 20 years later, like, we realize, oh, did you know that this person, you know, has got all these tendencies and qualifications? And then, oh, okay, well, let us engage him in that way now.
That's what happens.
That's what happens now. That's right. But it's completely different to what we've seen in Prabhupada's purports and his instruction. Definitely. You know, if they're not properly situated, they will definitely become disgruntled and dissatisfied. And this is what we learned from Dhruva. You know, he said to Narada Muni, who's a great, wonderful spiritual teacher, that it's not as if, of course, Narada Muni was testing him, and Narada Muni is also testing him so that we can realize that not all instructions just apply. So this is Narada Muni's mercy to us as well. I'll give you this Dhruva Maharaj. Although, Narada was a little startled himself, just, how strong that Kshatriya spirit was. But, these things are, taking place as pastimes so we can derive the proper instructions. Yeah, so this is what happened. He gave an instruction which was perhaps would have been taken up by someone more of the Brahminical spirit, just like that, to just tolerate, be humble, forgive, forget, move on. At that, he wasn't going to get over that insult, and therefore the instruction actually. Now, had Narada Muni, now what would happen in our society is that if someone gives, as we explained before, sometimes someone can be, undergoing some. You see that sometimes there may be a devotee or some devotees who are causing, becoming extremely offensive or bullying or victimizing a particular devotee. That devotee, so this is in line with what we're speaking here about Dhruva Maharaj was actually victimized and by his mother. That person may then approach someone and say, well, I'm getting this, and, this is like very disturbing, I'm practically on the verge of leaving. In fact, I've had devotees come to me in this situation, even, within the last few months, and have told me that they've actually had trouble with devotees. They feel that they're just being oppressed and somewhat victimized. And now, if you say to that person, just tolerate, if they have what we're learning from Dhruva, if they have that just very elevated Brahminical, even amongst the Brahmanas, sometimes, Brahmanas will forgive better than everyone else, but even amongst Brahmanas, some forgive even more readily than others. But even Brahmanas, unless they're a Vaishnava of, they, to just forgive and move on and be humble and just tolerate everything and just forget it and put it right out of your mind is not that easy. To give someone instruction in that suit and say just tolerate, they'll become not only unable to follow it, they'll become very disturbed that the person actually is giving that advice, which to them is completely ridiculous.
And would you say that the people that are victimizing, is that because this whole Balanashram's out as well? So maybe if they were victimized, they wouldn't be victimizing.
That's right, yeah, that's a good point. That's right, yes. There obviously is, you've got some dissatisfaction there as well. Yeah. So it's sort of, one problem produces many others. Yeah.
On that same note, we hear about this also, that for example, when it comes to Saraswati Devi, somebody came and asked him a question. And he said, okay, you first go and clean the pots. When he came with doubts, he said, go and clean the pots. And then he did like that for some time, and then when he came back and said, yes, we have the doubts, concerns, no, my doubts are all clear. So we may think that I mean, we, many, for many people, like you were saying, clean the pots or even doing the kitchen service, that may seem given, but that may be actually beneficial for that person.
Yeah.
So, where do we draw a line where it is being victimized, or where you understand that it is actually good for us? There is, I mean, how do we understand? Like, okay, Dhruv Maharaj, maybe he had that, as I think he had that ability to understand himself, which I don't know whether I have at this age. But I'm just saying, where do we understand this?
Well, here, Narada Muni tested and observed Dhruva Maharaj. He tested him, he observed. If we give an instruction, someone comes along and they have some difficulty, they say, oh, you know, it's they're a new person that have come along, right? And they're highly educated, very wealthy, very good looking. They come along to Krishna consciousness. They've got big plans of being a big devotee. And they come along and say, yes, you know, I'd like to do some service. And someone says, oh, okay, come and I'll show you to the pot shed.
Now,
that was, you know, a common thing that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta says what he would do, and of course we also do that in our movement, so it's but you know, you give an instruction and you then also observe that particular person that you've given that instruction to, that are they, you know, now if they're got some natural spirit of a brahmana, then they'll be able to tolerate perhaps, you know, that the ego and pride and just doing some menial, so you know, that'll come very naturally, very quickly, or that we may observe, oh gee, that person has been highly insulted by that, and oh, so we understand, oh, okay, we've tested that person and it's not going to work with that one, you know. So, you know, you can give the instruction, but, you know, you have to observe, and this is what this purport is saying, you actually, the teachers and the gurus and the persons who are training, guiding, supervising others, they're supposed to observe their natural spirit, not that you give an instruction and then you walk off and you don't even know what happened to the person, or you don't care, or you just give an instruction and you say, well, you know, you're just going to better become a brahmana, you know, this is your first day and I want you to act like a brahmana, and if you can't do it, you know, you're out.
That is the duty of a spiritual master. He sees the psychophysical nature of the disciple and what he is, then he will give directions according to the...
He may adjust.
Yeah.
He may adjust. Yeah. That's how you go to the pot shed and
yeah. He'll understand the propensity.
That's right, yeah. Because he's observing. He's observing.
Mm.
He's observing.
Because he's expert,
yeah.
He can know who is suitable for what.
You know, not this time, but the previous Vyasa Puja offering I made to my spiritual master, it was actually based upon that although previously I had a lot of association my spiritual master, but you know, in the last few years we're in different parts of the world, so I don't have a lot. But what I have noticed is that even within whatever little communication we have, or you know, contact where we're both present, he observes me very, very carefully. And I'm astounded by how well he sort of, you know, just knows me and gives. And when he gives instructions, I feel that he's actually really picked up the essence of how I'm feeling. You know, what I sort of need, my situation like that. So In fact, that was one of the reasons why I chose him as a spiritual master in the very first instance. Because we're supposed to observe the spiritual master and the spiritual master. If you observe your spiritual master and you detect that, well, he's not looking at me, I don't even think he'd notice me. You know, you want a spiritual master that you may not have massive amounts of time together, but you want your spiritual master, you want to feel that he is observing your nature and, you know, he's got it proper, you know, like that. Not that his spiritual master he doesn't understand anything about you, you know. That's, you know, when Tamal Krishna Maharaj was asked to come to Australia to look after the Australian Yatra, he made some comments that I don't think I can do that because I don't know that I can relate to them, you know. So, you know, it was an honest, you know, there are, he didn't feel that he could properly understand what Australians were all about, and therefore he declined to actually act as their spiritual master. And that's the proper thing, not that because you're a guru, you just, you know, there must be that proper observing like that, yeah.
Telepathy.
Well, the supercell.
They say that still they feel that he's able to relate to them and somehow understand them. And
yeah.
When he speaks to them, he's able to speak to their heart.
So, you know, what is an example of that? What would be an example from Shastra of that? Yeah, well, more specifically, actually just a few verses back, Narada Muni was actually, the Lord had instructed Narada Muni to observe. So in the purport it describes that relationship between the Lord and the Supersoul, between the Guru and the Supersoul, empowers one to act as the Guru. So the super soul is within everyone's heart observing, and he empowers the spiritual master to understand what, you know, the super soul is also observing, you know, so that can be done through the super soul. You have the correct spiritual master and disciple, then, you know, the super soul as a biomedia empowers that relationship to be, you know, properly functional. So, you know, therefore, persons like, you know, you give the example of Jayapataka Maharaj or Radhanaswami, you know, they are, I think Prabhupada said to Jayapataka Maharaj, you can have 10,000 disciples or something like that, you know. You know, they're empowered by their spiritual master and by the super soul to execute the function of the spiritual master, you know, to a certain level.
And then they come here, they are
I accept Jayapataka Maharaj as my Shiksha Guru as well. I've known him since 1980 when I met him and, you know, used to swim with him, you know, in the bank of the Ganges in Mayapur and help him cover himself with mud and, you know, watch him dry out sunbaking on the banks of the Ganges and what have you. And listening to his classes. You know, I haven't had a huge amount of association with him, but I know that whenever I have been in his presence, you know, he is a person who takes an extraordinary amount of interest, you know, in a person's you know, spiritual progress, and he has some amazing ability to then come back and, you know, you remember the conversation he's had with, you know, many hundreds of people. And I remember one time I was sitting out on the bench out there across the courtyard, and some devotees had over some time caused me you know, a lot of disturbance, you know, just very bad behavior. And I was, you know, I was feeling somewhat you know, anyway, there's all, I really didn't feel too good sitting there. And he walked out of the, he came down the stairs, and he spotted me over there, and he came up, and he just walked straight over to me, and I stood up, and he just gave me a big hug. You know, and I thought, that's just, gee, that's just what I needed, you know. And so, you know, the spiritual master, you know, one can't be a guru without being empowered by the Lord. And the Lord empowers different gurus according to their level, you know, their relationship and their advancement and what have you. So there are varieties of, you know, gurus acting on various levels of spiritual advancement. So, you know, it is possible.
Just in mind my mother's question, as not as leaders, but as people receiving instructions, how do we know when an instruction is for our benefit? And how do we know when an instruction is actually going beyond the line and it is a little bit bullying or...
Yes. Well, you know, the rule of thumb is this, is that when we accept a guru in the official capacity. So we may have many Shiksha gurus, but sometimes we accept one, you know, we accept a Diksha guru, and sometimes we may accept a Shiksha guru in a very official capacity as well. When we do that, we have to carefully scrutinize that guru, because once you accept the guru, you actually have to accept their instruction. You know, there can be, you know, argument, you know, or you may challenge beforehand, but actually, you know, once accepting, you know, the guru, then you're supposed to scrutinize, yes, this is the person I can surrender to their instruction. So when they give you an instruction, you actually should surrender. Other persons, you know, who may be in various levels of Shiksha guru in an unofficial way, you may, you know, if something doesn't, you can challenge them, or you know, discuss or argue back and forth a little bit, you know, in a more, you know, like that way, to some degree, without being offensive. Or, you know, but that's
also confusing, though, because I read somewhere instructions that as soon as you see a senior Vaishnava, immediately you must take you must approach them. I said, and it doesn't matter from whom you take, but when you see a senior person, immediately you take shelter.
Yes, take shelter, but
that statement, it doesn't matter from whom you take, but immediately you should take once a senior.
What, whatever they say?
No, you must approach them to take shelter.
Yes, take shelter means you can.
But then you're saying that you should scrutinize and see whether. But they're saying they're not asking us to scrutinize it, because we know that there are certain people who are initiating. So you see a senior person, you immediately approach them. That was what. That was a straight instruction.
By who?
I think it was either by the
Guru Jampambu? That if you see a senior Vaishnava,
if you see a bona fide spiritual master, then you should surrender.
You must immediately approach him. And even Prabhupada said that.
So, surrender if they're representing Krishna because
take shelter.
Of whatever they say.
I mean, take shelter for initiation. Approach them to take, for initiation.
What have you already initiated?
No, you can only initiate it, that doesn't matter. You're already in that line. But you cannot initiate it then.
So, if you're not initiated and you see a bona fide spiritual master, you should immediately approach him and surrender to take initiation without scrutinizing them?
That wasn't mentioned.
See, scrutinizing in the sense that we know that they are basically under the ISKCON umbrella, they are being empowered to take devotees.
Mm.
Yeah. And they are seen as
old. What about the Sanatana Goswami's Hari Bhakti Vilas and Rupa Goswami's Nectar Devotion, which, you know, gives us the instruction that we should, you know, and Jiva Goswami's discussion in the Sandhavas, that we should, you know, at least for 1 year, generally the recommendation is at least for 1 year we should, you know, observe very carefully the spiritual master and his qualifications and give him the opportunity to observe us. Where does that one fit in?
That my understanding is basically these gurus simply are not qualified to not able to judge the guru.
Mm.
That's my understanding. Mm. Okay. But we are taking the umbrella that ISKCON have okayed them, so they are bona fide. They know about them, and so so ISKCON that way giving us that authority, or the green signal that they are.
Okay, so now you are saying.
Now, second is yes. We are taking shelter, so they will observe us for about a year. That's different.
So now you're saying that when you use the term guru, you're only referring to those who have been authorized to act as Diksha gurus.
Yes.
So that's a totally different thing to what I mean, was talking about.
No, that's what
Diksha gurus, you know, if someone has been authorized as Diksha gurus, but still there has to be that scrutiny over the course of a year. I mean, that's ISKCON GBC policy, which represents Prabhupada's, you know, teachings, which represents, you know, all the Acharya's teachings. But, you know, so now, you know, if someone has been, you know, authorized as a Diksha Guru, and therefore their qualities have already been scrutinized, and yes, that's a different thing, but in the beginning you seem to be just applying that across the board. That
no, I meant no,
in that context. That's okay.
And it said that you should not delay. Actually, it said that you have no business to try to see this ordinary. You should immediately approach them, because you are not qualified to try to judge them.
No, it's not a matter of judging them, but
see how that you can relate to them. To which guru you are related?
Well, this is what Sureshwara Prabhu's seminar was about. That he was saying that Diksha Guru who has the greatest influence in helping you to develop your relationship with Prabhupada's teachings and establishing you in some service that facilitates you feel part of, you know, facilitating Prabhupada's mission, that particular guru who most significantly does that, that's what you're observing. You're not saying that, you know, oh, this person is more tolerant than that one, and, you know, this person is, you know, a lot more lighthearted than that. You know, he was saying that based upon how you approach one guru, and, you know, that particular... This is what happened, the problem that happened in the past... was that some of even the gurus who had been scrutinized and authorized by the GBC were actually putting themselves almost as an obstruction between the disciples' relationship between Prabhupada. So what happened was that as Sureshwar himself, you know, there are examples where a guru said, you know, don't read Prabhupada's books, just take instruction from me. You know. Or. Yeah. So. And at the moment, you know, what is happening is that the GBC, of course, is certainly, you know, sending persons like Sureshwar all around the world to make sure people understand the proper position of the guru and Prabhupada and people who will come here for 10,000 years to Krishna consciousness. And those adjustments are, you know, although it's generally accepted and understood, there may still be some fine tuning as to make sure everyone who has been authorized is on that, you know, proper understanding fully. You know, there may be some, you know, we don't know, but there may still be some persons who are a little bit not quite up to that understanding, even you know, on the Diksha platform. But what you're saying is correct. So, for instance, you know, as Prabhupada gives the example that, you know, a child doesn't scrutinize their parents. You know, that's the, that, so, you know, it's, a child doesn't say, well, you know, my father said I have to get an education, and I was quite happy playing. I better just observe my father for, you know, the next month or so, because my instruction seems a little bit off, you know, as a current. So, and if I think that perhaps my father's got a few faults and, you know, stuff like that, then perhaps, you know, maybe I might start looking, I might move next door. Because, you know, the fellow next door seems to let his children take a few days off school. You know, it's understood that the child doesn't have to scrutinize their parents. They just, whatever they say, boom, without scrutiny, you just accept that because they have my interest. So that's how we accept a bona fide guru. You don't have to scrutinize, you just accept and surrender. That's, you know, so that is a fact. So we're not denying that. But, you know, one, we're applying that to Diksha gurus who have been authorized and recognized. What Sureshwar is saying is that the GBC also wants to authorize and recognize the Shiksha gurus, which doesn't really happen in ISKCON. In other words, the GBC should, you know, at the moment, people can be acting as prominent Shiksha gurus within the temple and have no recognition by anyone, you know. Or some can be and doing a good job, and some can be acting as Shiksha guru and doing a terrible job, and that's not being recognized. And therefore, you know, what he was saying was that actually the Shiksha gurus also should be properly authorized from the GBC level. You know. Therefore, if the Diksha gurus and the Shiksha gurus are properly authorized, and the Prabhupada's position is properly established, then what you're saying is correct. But that is that that's there are still some anomalies where that it's that's the proper system. What you're saying is correct. What and what Bhurujan Prabhu is saying, that is the proper system. Whether ISKCON has come to the point where everyone acting as a Shiksha or Diksha Guru is someone that you can just walk up to and surrender to is I think is debatable. I think we have to come to that position. So the philosophy is correct, but is ISKCON up to the standard where we can actually apply the philosophy? Because, you know, that's what I'm questioning. Not the philosophy, but are we up to the standard where, you know, we've implemented the guru system to the point where, yes, we're so confident that everything is going so nicely that there's a guru here, a Shiksha guru, Diksha guru, yes, we'll just surrender. That's what we should be doing, but that, we have a lot of work to go.
So, what is the Vedic system of Diksha for
the system of Diksha? Yeah, as. You know, understanding of the position of a guru is the Vedic understanding. They're not two different things.
I would ask, how the disciple finds a guru, or the guru finds a disciple, or right now what this one system is basically, you know, adjusted to fit to the current day and age. But in the Vedic system, for example, Narada Muni saw Guru Maharaj and immediately he gave the Harinam.
Yeah, well, Krishna sent the Guru. So therefore, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that, you know, Krishna helps the sincere soul find the Guru, and the Guru then trains the sincere soul to, you know, help him to, you know, find Krishna, attain Krishna. That is the Vedic system. So, in general, in ISKCON, if we help people to become sincere, and at the same time, while they're serving, we help them become properly situated, Krishna will help them. He will send the proper guru for them to, you know, give them, you know, establish that relationship like that. So, you know, there is a transcendental process. Therefore, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has, you know, those who are like sannyasis or, you know, they're not householders, you know, they travel far and wide, you know, to give every sincere soul the opportunity, you know, to come across a bona fide spiritual master. We see that in general, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed, when he was preaching in South India, he instructed that people become the guru where they are naturally situated. That, for instance, if there is a, you know, a big, you know, town, many little villages surrounding it, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is instructing, you know, you don't have to leave your village or your town or your business or your family. You just become the guru and instruct him in Krishna consciousness. They wanted to follow him and travel with him all over, but he said, no, you stay where you're situated, you become the guru. Therefore, you know, for instance, in you know, you find in places like Russia that Krishna, you know, some gurus will be taking birth, you know, and they, gradually they will go through the ISKCON and be trained, and you know, they will find a spiritual master, and then they will become a guru, and they may just preach particularly in that area in Russia. And Krishna is putting them there for the sincere souls, and he will put the sincere souls there, and, you know, but there is a natural system where you know, gurus can become prominent within the area that they're already familiar with. You know, I mean, if you look at some of the acharyas, you know, I mean, for instance, Rishikananda, he preached in Orissa. Where was he from? He was from that area, wasn't he? Shamananda.
Yeah.
So he was from that area. He got trained up in Vrindavan, and then he went back to that area and preached in that area where he was already born. And then Shamananda, he preached in another area where he was from, and then Srinivasacharya. You know, quite often the acharyas, although they may have, you know, they travelled a lot within that state and made thousands of disciples within that state. But occasionally when they go to Vrindavan or what have you, they pick up some disciples on the way. So, but the majority of their disciples were literally in the same, you know, the guru was born in that area and the disciples were born in that area. But occasionally, for one reason or another, sometimes the guru travels and they pick up disciples on the way. Prabhupada went to Jhansi. He picked up his first disciple in Jhansi. You know, wherever he went, he traveled. But so that, you know, there's a natural system where gurus, you know, will take birth in a certain country or state, and they will end up being the natural guru in that area. They have a very good understanding of the people and you know, the needs of that particular, you know, what sort of Maya has been oppressing that place, and, you know, and it's very easy for the people to relate to them and what have you. So there's that system. And at the same time, then there are Jagat Gurus, or, you know, well, they're all Jagat Guru in one sense, but there are other gurus, so we won't use the term, you know, who Paribrajaka Acharyas, who travel far and wide from their birthplace continually. They perhaps don't even go back. So they may pick up other disciples. But and then, so for instance, a person may be born in a certain place. There may be a particular guru who's also born in that same place, but he may take initiation from someone who travels through, who he's more attracted to. So there's sort of a natural system of, where gurus are emerging from the place and preaching in the place where they arise, and at the same time, if Krishna decides that another particular guru is more suitable for that disciple, he will get them to meet somehow or another. So Krishna helps. I mean, that's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, you know, Krishna helps you to find the guru, and then the guru helps you to find. But otherwise, it's quite normal that, you know, within Victoria, you know, if you go down a couple of hundred years from now, there should be, you know, many prominent Diksha Gurus who reside, you know, continually, and they'll be accepting disciples in Victoria, and they'll be preaching most in Victoria. And then there'll be other people travelling through. It depends a lot on the disciple as well, because, you know, part of observing the guru, we just described before, that some disciples, if their guru comes through once every 3 years, you know, they're not going to be happy. they want to see the guru every day. And if you observe, you know, that, oh yes, my guru comes once a year, once every 2 years, once every 5 years, I don't think that's, you know, I need someone. So if you're observing that, then don't accept that person as guru. Others actually are more comfortable when they don't see their guru too often. They like to know that they've been initiated into the disciplic succession, and basically they're just ready to preach, and they contact their guru on certain issues, but mostly they're just acting, you know, they're quite happy to not be, having to answer to the guru or what have you, you know, every single day. So that's, you know, from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. This is one thing that ISKCON is now, you know, ISKCON GBC is now trying to establish, is that, you know, they want not just one or two gurus for a whole zone. They want many, many gurus. They want to follow Prabhupada's instructions, many, many gurus, you know, that each town, village, state, country has many gurus, shiksha and diksha, you know, many, many. If they're qualified, let them be guru. You know, that was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's instruction to everyone. When Prabhupada used to preach that, you know, that's what Prabhupada said. In fact, I heard a lecture the other day, Prabhupada was saying, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, you become a guru, he wasn't leaving it open. He was saying, you become a guru, you know, I want you to. Now, whether you do or not is another thing, but he was wanting, you know, you become a guru, which means that according to your capacity, if you can just preach to your own family or the people in your work, then do that, but do it. Why shouldn't you be discussing Krishna's, you know, instruction? Why shouldn't you be thinking about Krishna? Why shouldn't you be, you know, reflecting on Krishna within your family? If someone is a father and they're not a guru, they're not qualified to be a father. You know, that's the instruction of Shastra. So if you're a father, you actually have to become a guru. What does that mean? You have to be teaching, you know, and understanding Bhagavad Gita. Like that. If you're not, you're not really qualified as a father or like that. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying, become a guru, everyone like this, become a guru, teach people, understand Bhagavad Gita, teach them. That. If that system is followed, then there should be many, many, many gurus, you know, and it becomes very easy. That if you want someone who's totally familiar with, you know, your country, state, you know, cultures and what have you, one will accept a guru within that. Or if you want someone who's, you know, travels the world and like that, then accept. You know. So again, it comes up to observing and Krishna helping you, sending the guru so you can observe. Any other comments on any of that? Was a very, you know, that's just one purport. We haven't got very far. To verse 36, we're reading. So this is, you know, in question 4, mood and mission. It's asking that you select passages from chapter 8. Which reflect Prabhupada's mood and mission, and discuss the relevance of these statements for ISKCON's development. See? So, even in that one verse, verse 36, there are so many issues that so far we've discussed for an hour and a half, but one purport so many issues which are completely irrelevant for the development of ISKCON, which is what that question wants you to do. So, you know, you can literally just play this tape back and you've got the basis of a good essay just from that one thing. But, you know, other topics which come up, it highlights, just to make it easy for you, verses 38 and 40, 54 and 56 and 78 and 80. Now, 38 and 40 on mood and mission, here, Dhruva says, "My dear Lord, you are a worthy son of Lord Brahma and you travel playing on your musical instrument, the Veena, for the welfare of the entire universe. You are like the sun which rotates in the universe for the benefit of all living beings." So, Dhruva was hoping that Narada Muni would show his mercy, just as the sun distributes its sunlight to everyone. And help him to fulfill his desires through good instruction. So, again, Sri Gopal, your question. Here, Dhruva Maharaj is asking Narada Muni to give him instruction that helps him fulfill his desires, which are basically of a Kshatriya nature. And what does Prabhupada say in the purport? Because we were discussing before, you know, whether is ISKCON, you know, did Prabhupada just try to train up Brahmanas? He couldn't really show interest in training up Kshatriyas or Vaishnavas. Here in this purport, we see the Prabhupada. This purport and the next one. Verse 39 says, "Now Narada did become compassionate toward him, and he, by his causeless mercy, he gave him the following expert advice." In verse 40, he says, "The instruction given by your mother Sunidhi to follow the path of devotional service to the Supreme Lord is just suitable for you. You should therefore completely absorb yourself in the devotional service of the Lord." Now, Dhruva, he wanted an abode even greater than Lord Brahma's. Basically, just a big material desire. Something to rule over, like a Kshatriya. Now, his desire could not be fulfilled by any demigod worship because he wanted an abode greater than Brahma's. How's Brahma going to fulfill that? To organise something, you know, the greatest he could do is produce his own abode. So, no demigod. So, therefore, Narada Muni's understanding, well, you know, the only one who can produce an abode greater than even Lord Brahma is no demigod. Only the Lord's going to help you there. He asked him to worship Krishna. In verse 41 it says, "Any person who desires the fruits of the four principles, religiosity, economic development, sense gratification, at the end liberation, should engage himself in devotional service to Krishna. For the worship of his lotus feet fulfills all of these." So, Narada Muni therefore advised that even for religiosity, economic development, sense gratification and liberation, one should approach the Lord, offer prayers and ask for the fulfillment of one's desires at the lotus feet of the Lord. This is real intelligence. You know, an intelligent person never goes to the demigods. In the Bhagavad Gita we know that Krishna says that Performance of ritualistic ceremonies is not actually religion. The real path of religion is to surrender to the lotus feet of the Lord. You know, such a person who surrendered doesn't really have any separate endeavor for economic development. Prabhupada mentions at the bottom of verse 41 in the purport, it says, in other words, even if one is full of material desires, he can continue his devotional service to the Lord and all his desires will be fulfilled. Okay. So, we were discussing about accepting a spiritual master. So, Narada Muni is giving instruction to Dhruva that even to fulfill his material desires he should worship the Lord. He gives him a particular mantra and we see he engages him in the worship of the deity and to chant a particular mantra as he's meditating upon the Lord. And in the beginning to, you know, practice Astanga Yoga and to fix the Lord, you know, within his mind, within his consciousness, and to also, you know, produce a form of the Lord which he's meditating upon. So, here, Narada Muni is again giving instruction which is very beneficial for someone with strong material desires. Now many people come to ISKCON or you know to Krishna consciousness and they all have some major material desires going on within their heart. And sometimes there is a tendency, or you know, especially previously in ISKCON, that our mood of preaching was to just tell people that they had to give up whatever desire they had within their heart and just surrender to Krishna and basically, you know, you just... You know, don't cultivate any other desire, just surrender to Krishna like that. How many people do you think did that? You know, anyone who comes, you know, to ISKCON, like, you know, we have so many people now, you know, in a huge congregation. One of the reasons, because we have such a big congregation is because we don't necessarily always tell them as they come in to just, you know, you have this desire, you want to get a big house and have a nice family, and, you know, have a nice business and, you know, whatever, you know. Give up all those desires and then, you know, come and let's discuss Bhagavad Gita like that. Here, you know, he is saying that Dhruva Maharaj is actually, he's fixed, you know, I want this desire fulfilled. And so he's saying that, okay, if you have that desire, then you worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
In addition to that, why did Narada Muni ask him to do Ashtanga Yoga? Chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya and meditating on the form of the Lord Vyana?
Was it that it's a different yoga from that yoga?
It's a different yoga.
Yeah.
The Kali Yuga, the
think Kaliyuga said you can only chant Hare Krishna to get perfection.
Any age, any age. Yeah.
That's
about
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna came much later. Well, you know, for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, it's the same. It's the same thing that Krishna, ultimately, Krishna has, you know, one real major instruction in the Bhagavad Gita, and that is surrender unto me, fully, giving up everything. Now, he says to Arjuna that, okay, I will explain to you about Karma Yoga, I'll explain to you about Jnana Yoga, I'll explain to you about Astanga Yoga. He does all those, and he explains to him about Bhakti Yoga. In the end, he says, I've explained all these different things to me, which means that you can now take up my instructions on Karma Yoga, you can follow what I've said about Jnana Yoga, you can follow what I said about Astanga Yoga, or, Arjuna, you can simply become a bhakta, become my devotee, always think of me, and surrender unto me in bhakti yoga. You do as you wish to do. So Arjuna, you know, he surrendered to Krishna in bhakti yoga. Now, generally when people read the Bhagavad Gita, they usually take to Karma Yoga or Jnana Yoga or Astanga Yoga. You know, it's very rare people actually take to Bhakti Yoga. You know, very, very rare. Krishna says that. Manushanam sahasrasyu kastinyam. So he says to Arjuna, you know, deliberate on everything I've said. I've told you so many things. You think about it. Do you want to become a Karma Yogi and fulfill your desires in that way? Do you want to become a Jnani, Astanga Yogi, like that? Or you want to just surrender unto me and give up all the results of these other paths? You deliberate and do it. So Arjuna,
he's telling his intention, like after telling Jnana, Karma, Ashtanga, everything, finally he's telling, abandon all the righteous of religion and just surrender.
And he says that this is the easiest, it's the best, and you'll get whatever results you get from the other paths, you're going to get from Bhakti anyway, so you might as, you know, really, you know, I'm saying, take the Bhakti, Arjuna, take the Bhakti. But, you know, he's, you know, but you can become a Karma Jnani like that if you like. That is the role of a spiritual master. That he, you know, he didn't just say to Arjuna, look, you know, I'll tell you right from the beginning, Arjuna, you surrender unto me, I won't bother going into a whole discussion here. You just become my devotee and just forget everything else. You know. You know, Krishna examined Arjuna. As a spiritual master, he gave him appropriate instruction and then left it up to him. So Narada Muni is, you know, doing a similar thing. That he's observing Dhruva Maharaj and he's giving him a process which he understands is, you know, going to be most acceptable to him.
Actually,
he tests Dhruva Maharaj's determination also. He says that you are too young, now it's time for you
to play.
Mm.
Don't just to test how serious he is, but he's apparently.
Which is, you know, Nirmala's gone out, but, you know, It's an interesting point because, for instance, you know, as Nirmala was saying, that when you see a guru, if they're a bona fide guru, there's no reason not to surrender. You know, they're just going to help you attain Krishna and do that immediately. But even though the guru is in that position where, you know, someone should go up and surrender to them, and then even if that person does go up and surrender, you give me instruction and, you know, whatever is best for me, still that spiritual master is going to instruct that disciple and test them and give them instruction according to their level of Krishna consciousness. So you might go up to a guru and say, I am completely surrendered unto you. Only a fool would say, oh, he said it, so he must be completely surrendered. I'm just going to get him to, you know, gee, you know, go to your bank, empty it all out, sell your house, leave your wife, you know. Come with me, you can assist me. I'm going to Africa tomorrow. We are preaching all around the world. I didn't mean surrender like that, you know. Even if someone says, you know, I am completely surrendered. Oh, Maharaj, you're so, you know, empowered. You know, I believe in you. Still, he's going to give instruction. He's going to test and give instruction according to, you know, his ability. So, Narada Muni is doing that with Dhruva. He's seeing his, you know, capacity, his level, and he's giving him a particular instruction. He's not just going, you know, this is the problem that sometimes Hare Krishna devotees have, is that everyone gets the one instruction. Chant Hare Krishna and surrender to Krishna. You know, give up all your material desires, surrender to Krishna, chant Hare Krishna, that's it. And even if they say that, you know, I'm ready to do anything, you know, like that, you know, we understand that it's extremely rare for, you know, people to. We understand because Krishna says it, that amongst many, many thousands among men, you know, one man, you know, devotees are very, very rare. And then even among the devotees, you know, devotees who are on very elevated levels of Krishna consciousness, they're more rare. And then, you know, fully surrendered devotees, you know, are extremely rare, you know. So we just... the spiritual master, one, you know, to be. This is why, if we just say that we see a guru and we just take it without proper understanding of that statement, that we just go up and surrender, and then we have so many gurus in ISKCON and they're thinking, well, you know, I'm qualified as a guru, I've been given shiksha, therefore, you know, I'll just give instruction, you know. And they ask people to, you know, they give them instruction which is impractical for them and which actually causes them detriment to their spiritual life. You know, both the spiritual master, the disciple and ISKCON will all go to hell. You know, if we have a system like that where the guru is giving inappropriate instruction, the disciple is, you know, inappropriately surrendering to gurus who are not qualified, the whole thing becomes a sham where everyone just goes, you know, ends up sliding down to, you know, chaos.
So it also
seems
like because...
So this is a very, you know, this is a very good instruction by Narada Muni, you know. He did, you know, to just measure out an instruction which is appropriate to Dhruva. And not just give a blanket, you know, medicine. You don't go to a doctor and just give a blanket medicine. So even though in Kali Yuga, you know, it is chanting Hare Krishna and what have you, and in certain yugas, still, you know, for instance, if you go to a doctor, there may be a standard medicine for a certain ailment. But then it is given in different doses. That one person may get it, you know, 1/100th of what another person is getting. And another person may get even the same dose but with a different diet. Another person may get the same dose with a different diet and a different exercise regime, plus something else along with it. So even though there are standard medicines, still according to the doctor and the patient, there is still so much variety in how much even a standard medicine is given. Like that. Yeah. So, we were looking at mood and mission. Discuss the relevance of these statements for ISKCON's development. So we looked at 38 and 40. There was also in 54 and 56, since we're on this mood and mission, we're on a mission for mood and mission. We're on a mission from God. Now, in verses 54, you see that apart from the, Ashtanga Yoga. Is given in verses 42 to 44. Right. That process. And from 54, even 53, it says, I'll give you a mantra which is to be chanted with this process of meditation. And that's the Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. One who carefully chants this mantra for 7 nights can see perfect human beings flying in the sky. So, here, now we discuss giving of mantras and deity worship. Again, part of things that have importance to the way ISKCON develops in how, you know, instructions are given to disciples of different levels. Now, here, Narada uses the word japaha, which indicates that the mantra to be chanted is very confidential. Japa. So, one may ask, so japa is chanted a little softly, even quietly. One may ask, if it is confidential, why is it mentioned in the writing of the Srimad Bhagavatam? It's confidential in this sense that one may receive a published mantra anywhere, but unless it is accepted through the chain of disciplic succession, the mantra does not act. And another point established in this verse is that the meditation should be carried out while chanting the mantra. As soon as one chants the Hare Krishna mantra, he sees the form of Krishna, Rama, and their energies, and that is the perfect stage of trance. One should not try artificially to see the form of the Lord while chanting, but when the chanting is performed defenselessly, the Lord will automatically reveal himself to the view of the chanter. So he gives him this mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And he tells him that while meditating upon the Lord, He should chant the mantra and he should also install a form of the deity that he makes, you know, in the form of the Lord, and offer him, you know, certain foodstuffs and certain worship. Now, this mantra begins with Pranava Omkara. There is an injunction that those who are not Brahmanas cannot pronounce the Pranava mantra. They cannot chant Omkara. Have you heard that? If you're not a Brahmana, you're not supposed to chant even the Omkara mantra, you know, the Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Dhruva was born a Kshatriya, so, you know, we have the twice born. So you have the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, and the Vaishyas can all become twice born. What mantra do the Kshatriyas chant? Does anyone know? Do they?
They have the string. Yeah.
And they can learn the Vedas.
And they chant
Vedas. Yeah. And they chant Gayatri Mantra. And the Vaishyas.
Yeah.
So here it's saying, you know, that's why this mantra is to be chanted, you know, so that's why. Is chanted by, and it begins with, there is an injunction, those who are not Brahmanas cannot pronounce the Pranava mantra. Still, although not a Brahmana but a Kshatriya, Dhruva was allowed on the authority of Narada to pronounce the Pranava Omkara. This is very significant, especially in India. The caste Brahmanas object greatly when persons from other castes who are not born in Brahmana families recite this Pranava mantra. But here is tacit proof that if a person accepts a Vaishnava mantra, a Vaishnava way of worshipping the deities, he is allowed to chant the Pranava mantra. So what does that mean? You know, if they say in India, you know, that the Brahman is, say, if you're not born in a Brahmana family, you can't chant the Pranava mantra. Has anyone heard anything about that? Because, you know, that was mine. So they're all three castes are getting the
initiation.
They're all chanting the Gayatri Mantra, which is, you know, starts with Om. So, you know, what I'm trying to understand is, what is Prabhupada referring to here where the Brahmanas are objecting? Does anyone know? Has anyone heard of that?
I think that is not the Vedic. That is the period when all that corruption came in and the Brahmanas were by birth. So they were feeling that all this Omkara should not be told by the people. It is not according to Veda. It's my understanding.
Yes, but are they objecting? Say a Kshatriya is a Kshatriya by birth and they're chanting the Gayatri Mantra. Do they object to that? Only the Brahmanas
should
chant the Gayatri Mantra.
The corruption scheme, yes.
But
yes.
If they have the Upanayanam done for Kshatriyas and Vaishyas,
They do. They're all twice born.
Maybe the mantra that they give, it's a secret mantra, right? The Guru is in the maybe it's different, I don't know. Is there any Kshatriyas in the room?
Does anyone know? Is it?
Yeah.
They give the Gayatri. And that's the norm from the Vedic age. They give the Gayatri to the Kshatriyas and to the...
I have seen in practice that when they give Upanayanam, they give first the Gayatri, Brahma
Gayatri. So...
Because when... In, at least from the family, I don't know, from the background that I come, but Brahma family, they're supposed to be Brahma.
To chant the Gayatri.
Having been born in a Brahma family, from that background, I'm saying that it was only a Brahma child who was given the Upanayanam.
Yeah.
I do not know about any.
Yes.
Any other caste.
Right. No, no, they, I think, for instance, with, what of a Bandhu's boy? What's his name?
Brahma Bandhu, or Dvija Bandhu?
What of a Bandhu?
Yeah. Yeah.
No. And Leela Mai. not the, that's it. Yeah, that's right. Uddhava Bandhu, his boy, I thought his name, is Brahma Bandhu. I thought, what a strange name to give your child, and then to give him, because especially because they wanted him to, because the custom is when they're 8 to 10 or 12, they give them the Gayatri. They don't want them to wait until they're 16 or 18 or what have you. They want them, as it's always been done, with 8 and 12. So he asked me, and I said, well, that sort of threw me. I thought, well, what do I do? So I said no, because, I've never experienced where, they want me to give someone Brahman. I said, well, I'm not qualified to, give someone Brahman. And they said, no, it's just like a ritual thing. And I'm saying, but do we want, just a ritual thing? And there was a big discussion. And a few devotees were there, and I think in the end, I think they wrote to Jayapataka Swami Maharaj, who said, yes, it's okay for him to just, it's just like a, you can give that initiation, because it is the normal tradition, so we're not going to stop a person's normal tradition, what was done in the Vedas, but the real, he will get Brahman initiation again later once he accepts a guru, and that in essence it's it's like where a family priest does a ceremony. It's different. It's slightly different to when the spiritual master, who's in the cyclic succession, gives the Gayatri Mantra in the terms of that person is then qualified to worship the deity of Krishna. So, in other words, in ISKCON, when we give the Brahma Gayatri, it means that that person has come to the position of being a fixed up devotee in disciplic succession. When they do the Brahman initiation for the children, it's almost like saying, this person is a Brahmana by birth and they've performed all the requisite samskaras like that. We're not saying he's a fixed up devotee, trained up, predominantly in the mode of goodness, come to Nishta, bhakti standard like that. So they have different meanings, like that. But it can be done in that sense, And therefore, I think Nisringa Kavacha did the ceremony.
Because that
they haven't given the Vaishnava. Yeah, yeah, that's right. It's a good point.
Is it only they give before a child is seriously going to take up studies? Like, just before that?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So then, you know, they're studying and they're also studying the scriptures and what have you. So, in other words, you're supposed to get the Brahma Gayatri before you take up studies rather than you take up studies. So,
I'll make this like a personal example.
Yeah.
When my Shastri initiation, you know, I had a friend actually. So Narasimha Kavacha was there. You know, this
you had a thread?
Yeah, I had a thread.
Already in your first initiation.
Then he said, cut that thread. Narasimha Kavacha. Guru Maharaj was there, first initiation. Cut that thread. What is it? This is with the unqualified Brahmins in India. We all know all that, you know. I just kept quiet. Second time he said, it's not just. Take it out, you know. And slowly I went to Guru Maharaj. I said, Narasimha Kavacha is telling me, let it be in the sun. Guru Maharaj
instructed. Yeah, yeah. Who is your Guru Maharaj?
Jatavani.
Jatavani. That's right.
He said, let it be in the sun. You don't have to bother. Don't worry.
That's nice, no?
No, I said, Guru Maharaj said, let it be in the sun.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's it. You know, again, you know, one of the things we're discussing is how ISKCON gives appropriate instruction, you know, that is not deriding, you know, a person's situation in life, but gradually bringing them, you know, to spiritual life, but, you know, not just making them, would say, abandon everything they know and, you know, as the foundation for their existence. You know, you just abandon that immediately and just immediately take the Krishna consciousness. You know, we have to avoid.
If Guru Maharaj asked me to remove it, I would have removed it.
Yes.
But he did not tell me. He said,
let it be
there,
let's
don't bother.
Yes.
From another note, my experience was for us, son Abhishek. Before giving, doing Saisanya, I asked many people actually. I asked Karanidhi Prabhu. In fact, we talked to even one Swami Maharaj. And he said to go ahead. Then I asked my son, I was like, will you do Gayatri if I give you the, I don't want to just namesake. He in fact he was keen at that time, so we went through it, and he did it sincerely for 2 years. Then somehow he started feeling that no, it is not this. I'm following ISKCON, and I've got it from an exalted devotee. He got it from Shinide Swami, an exalted devotee. But that is not following the line of ISKCON. So I can't follow two gurus from two sampradayas. So he started feeling a conflict, and he said, no, I'm going to stop. Bansam Mahal gave him permission. He said, no, I don't feel comfortable, and he stopped.
Okay.
I don't know that it's okay. I don't know
if
it is stopped or
so your husband's
okay
have the
not okay.
God.
But he stopped.
And we
but did. He
did. I'm not going to say anything.
No,
he
took
it out.
Once you take it out, again there has to be a re-initiation thing.
So he took it out and he said, I'm not.
It's neither here nor there to do.
I
don't know.
You know, it's fine for them to continue their ordinary religious practices, you know, and there's no harm there. So
it is supposed to be an offense. It is supposed to be an offense if you have taken a wrong chance.
No. If he is decided to follow the line of a properly situated spiritual master, you know, and giving up something that may have been done according to family traditions, then there's no offense there. we see that some of our acharyas did a similar thing. They, had a family priest, but so I think Bhaktivinoda Kaur was initiated, there are a few of them, they're initiated, but they just basically considered it just, a family priest or a family ritual, and when, the actual spiritually situated spiritual master was there, then they just, severed that relationship pretty much, just forgot about it, just, discontinued it, and just took that, established their relationship with Krishna. When something doesn't have a relationship with Krishna and you're giving it up, that is not an offence. No, if you're doing something to properly establish a relationship with Krishna, that is always a good thing.
I think my brother says my mother was grieving because he was not given the mantra by a normal priest, but by a very exalted Vaishnava.
So in that case, Prabhupada makes a point in this purport that when the mantra is given by the spiritual master, the bona fide spiritual master, then the mantra will act. Otherwise it will not.
He felt a conflict between the sampradayas. He says, I'm not following that sampradaya. How can I
pursue? Which is correct. I mean, some of the acharyas, their family priest was still a Vaishnava, but it was still more of a family ritual given by a Vaishnava. But when a spiritual master performed the samskara according to the Vaishnava traditions, coming the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then they had no qualms of giving up that the connection with that other guru, even though they were Vaishnavas. It's not that they were Mayavadis or impersonalists or demigods. Or something like that.
He was following Madhva Samudaya. He was not associated with the Mahaprabhu movement. And he was a sannyasi, and he had decided he was not a very high person, and he had his guru. When he met, I think, disciples of Rajkant, in
Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur.
Could be. First conversation was not with Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, but one of the other. So that point of time, that later of course he got Shiksha from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and he got the Pashto. But then at that moment he had this conflict.
And then, you have Gopala Bhatta Goswami and his parents who are in the Sri Sampradaya, very well situated there. Do something which is strictly in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is acceptable. If we forego other things, even though they do have a spiritual connection, to be more fixed up in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then that is acceptable. We have to be careful, of course, that we don't uh, You know, we don't want to have a sort of arrogance where we're creating offences to other Vaishnavas in other sampradayas by sort of, we say, making them feel obsolete or insignificant. You know, we don't want to have that sort of an attitude where we just neglect them at the drop of a hat. But at the same time, there is it seems that there is a precedent. So, you know, my question still remains is that, you know, Prabhupada is saying that, okay, it must be, especially the caste Brahmanas object greatly when persons from other castes who are not born in Brahmin families recite this Pranava mantra. So, it seems that, as you were saying, Nirmala, it's just referring to people not born in a Brahmin family or not born in a Kshatriya family or not born in it, who have been given the Gayatri Mantra. So they all evidently appear to chant the Gayatri Mantra. Is that your understanding? The Brahmins, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, if they're twice born, they all chant the Gayatri Mantra. Hands up those who accept that all the twice born chant the Gayatri Mantra. If that's your understanding. Yeah. Yeah. Those who think it's just the Brahmanas?
No. If you're given initiation, you chant.
Okay. No, I'm just saying previously, like, you know, yes. Yeah. Only the Brahmanas and Gayatri, you're saying?
No. If they were given initiation, then they were chanting. Once they're given initiation, they
were chanting. That means twice born. Yeah. Brahman. Okay. All right. So here it's just not referring specifically to Brahmanas, but to. He's saying Brahmanas in the sense of all the twice born. If they're not born in the twice born family, then they shouldn't be chanting. But that's what it's about. See, then Prabhupada says, but here is tacit proof that if a person accepts the Vaishnava mantra or Vaishnava way of worshipping the deities, he's allowed to chant the Pranava mantra. So, because, see, you know, here it says, there is an injunction that those who are not Brahmanas, he's saying not by birth but not Brahmanas, cannot pronounce the Pranava mantra. But Dhruva was born a Kshatriya. So he's actually, Prabhupada is saying that, you know, there is a Vedic injunction where only the Brahmanas are supposed to chant the, you know, Pranava mantra or Omkar, which would, you know, also mean Gayatri Mantra.
Yeah.
That's why he said, they're saying that there's an injunction there.
Is that similar to that only Brahmins that are allowed to study the Vedas?
Yes, that's right. So, I think in that case, you know, Brahmins are allowed to study the Vedas. Others can also study the Vedas, but they're, you know, what it means is all the twice born can study the Vedas, but only the Brahmins are supposed to teach. Right? So therefore, if you're studying the Vedas, you must be chanting Pranava Om. So if you're, you know, a Vaishya and or a Kshatriya and you're studying under a Brahmin, you've got to be chanting Om. So it again, it may refer to in that sense that, you know, teaching, you know, there's a little bit more to this.
We can say in Ambarish Maharaj, he was a Kshatriya, that he was worshipping the deity.
He was,
and he was engaging all
the,
but that was in the good old days when that corruption was not there.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But once the corruption came, once the corruption came, I don't know about Kshatriya becoming twice born. Before that, yes. That's where I'm confused. I'm not aware of.
Okay. If someone can research that, that in the Vedic age, did all the three twice born chant the Gayatri Mantra. That's what I'd like, you know. If someone can receive, you know. Yeah, he's saying that only the Brahmins seem to chant it. That's very clear. That's right. That's right. So that to me is very clear. But then it seems that there's a consensus that, you know, for instance, when I do a yajna, quite often, you know, the people who come along say, "Oh, let's chant the Gayatri," and they all chant it out aloud every time I throw, you know, the rice, and they're doing the whole Gayatri. I'm saying, but you know, you're supposed to, you know, you're not supposed to be doing that. I know a couple of times I've tried to, we don't do that. And you know, they're looking at me as if, hey, you know, friends of the little Western rascal. You know, so I sort of just let them go now. But you know, it seems to be a commonly accepted thing that somehow you're twice born, Brahma Vashya, that you do. And you know, so I'd like to, if someone can research that.
But nowadays, everybody has taught the Gayatri Mantra in India. For some of the small children also learn the Gayatri Mantra among the many other slokas.
Yes.
So that's it's how I learn.
Yes.
It's played loudly in some supermarket.
You can get it, you know, you go and buy a clock, right? It's got the Gayatri on it, and, you know, there's like.
Phone
rings. Yeah, right. Phone rings.
See, you go. Read this one from Chaitanya Dhamma about the choice one. It says, "One who cannot be brought nearer to a spiritual master cannot have a sacred right, and thus he is indicated to be a Shudra." So this means that other three have sacred rights.
They have the sacred thread, yes. I remember seeing that. Yeah.
The sacred thread on the body of a Brahmana, Kshatriya, or Vaishya is a symbol of initiation by the spiritual master and is worth nothing if worn merely to boast of high parentage. The duty of the spiritual master is to initiate a disciple with the sacred thread ceremony. And after this samskara or purificatory process, the spiritual master actually begins to teach the disciples about the Veda.
Right, you teach it.
Yeah, a person born a Shudra is not barred from such spiritual initiation, provided he is approved by the spiritual master, who is duly authorized to award a disciple the right to be a Brahmana if he finds him perfectly qualified.
So, yeah, I've always understood that they all get the thread, but does everyone who has a thread also chant the Gayatri Mantra? So, you know, I understand that, you know, the Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas all have a thread. But is it only the Brahmanas who get the Gayatri Mantra? Or do all three of them get the Gayatri? Is that the original Vedic? What did they do in the original Vedic way? That's what I want to know. Here, Prabhupada seems, as Tirthapada is saying, that it is quite clear that Prabhupada is saying actually it's not necessarily a matter of just those born in Brahmana families, but there's an injunction that you have to be a Brahmana to actually chant the, you know, the mantras. In the Vaishnava tradition, one can be elevated to the Brahminical platform. And even though one is a sutra or what have you, one can also chant the Gayatri Mantras. So my question then would be, in ISKCON, when we give the Gayatri Mantra and twice born, does that mean that we're expecting that person to be a Brahmana because we're giving them the Gayatri Mantra? Or that when we give the Gayatri Mantra, that they can act as a Vaishya or a Kshatriya and also, see? That's my next question. So if someone can just research that, it appears that it's actually just Prabhupada's saying it, that Gayatri is just meant for the Brahmins. That's what it appears from this purport. A very strong statement by Prabhupada.
We call it Brahminical initiation.
We do, yeah, we do. It's called Brahminical initiation, not called Kshatriya Vaishya or you know. Yeah. I'm with you, dear the Puff. But yes, that's what Prabhupada is saying, and therefore those who take, you know, it would beg the question that if you're taking twice born in ISKCON, you are expected to take up Brahminical work, not necessarily as a Vaishya or a Kshatriya. And therefore, if someone has those propensities, but can you call me back in 2 minutes? Thanks. But in ISKCON, when we initiate someone as a Vaishnava, Prabhupada states in the Krishna book and several places that you actually have to be a Brahmin to become a Vaishnava. You cannot be a Vaishnava without being a Brahmana, which means that even if you act as a Vaishya or a Kshatriya, because you're a Vaishnava, it's understood you have the qualities of a Brahmana, even though you may act as a Vaishya or Kshatriya as a devotee. So that, in that sense, it may be acceptable. But anyway, if someone can look into that for me, that would be very good. And
I have one question.
Can I ask now?
It's really
because I actually... Is it 3 to 5? Yeah.
Actually, on this point, I had a big discussion with Sweta and he disagreed.
Yes.
He could not agree. And
this is 3 to 5. Yeah. Yeah.
No, the question is, yes, Dhruva Maharaj was given instruction when Narada Muni describes the form of the Lord.
Yes.
He says his eyebrows are so beautiful, his eyes are like that, he describes his body, he describes his limbs. And he says, you meditate on the Lord like that. Now, I've heard so many things like, for example, that we shouldn't, actually we are not supposed to enjoy the Lord. Actually, our mood should be to serve the Lord. That is one thing that I've heard. The second thing, all acharyas keep stressing that between the seeing and hearing, it is more important that we hear the Maha Mantra. So my point to Sweta was, okay, we can chant. When we're chanting, okay, we're not concentrating to see the Lord. Our focus, we may be chanting in front of the Lord, but the focus is on the mantra. But then we should spend some time when we're just seeing the Lord so that we can appreciate the Lord and all the features of the Lord. But Sweta says, no. Whenever you see the Lord, you should be offering prayers to the Lord.
So...
So
we need some police to monitor who might be enjoying themselves while they're standing in front of the deities, you know. We'll give them a little prod with a stick. Is that?
So, I mean, what is the correct instruction according to Shastra?
Yes, you know, it's correct. The basic principle is we go before the Lord for His pleasure. That's the a devotee's mood is they're always presenting ourselves to Krishna in the form of the holy name or in the form of the deity or in the form of the Vaishnava. We're presenting ourselves for their pleasure as their servant. So that's the correct mood. That position is extremely blissful position, and that bliss is automatic. You don't so. Unless it gets in the way of your service, don't worry about it. You know, so like Daruka, who was fanning the Lord for his pleasure, but the ecstasy was meaning he couldn't fan the Lord properly, so therefore become a disturbance. So then he tried to control it. But, you know, it's a natural part of... So we go to the Lord for his pleasure, but you'll naturally become blissful. But unless it disturbs your service... There's no harm, it's just natural, you know.
No, I mean,
it's like when you eat, you naturally become satisfied and you know, you know, full and happy.
No, that's not the point. Yeah. The point is whether we should minutely observe the Lord. We should spend time in the temple, not in the building. Really minutely observing and just observing the Lord. Should we do that or not?
My point was that you can do that, but you should be either chanting or offering prayers while you're doing that. And my mother's point was, if I do that, then I can't really see the Lord. So better I chant separately and see the Lord separately.
Well, you know, it's absolute. Prabhupada says in the Nectar Devotion that when you follow one of the processes of devotional service properly, so Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyamatman, Navidam, if you do one properly, so if you do Archanam properly, then you automatically will be performing the other ones as well. So if you're properly worshipping the deity, if you're standing before Krishna, that name of Krishna, you know, there's Krishna, I'll get Krishna's garlands, I'll look, Krishna has beautiful toes, and you're Krishna. You're chanting, you know, in your head. It is there as well. And if you're chanting, as Prabhupada said in the last purport, then if you're chanting, you'll be thinking of it, offenselessly, you'll be thinking of his pastimes. They're absolute. If you do one properly, you'll actually execute all nine.
But at this stage, I'm not able to do them simultaneously.
You just do what you can.
So can I stand the Lord? Is it allowed for me to stand before the Lord and just observe and just enjoy Him? I can't. See how beautiful His legs are. How beautiful His...
Yeah. There is.
Actually, he won't mind.
He doesn't mind.
So two citations are there.
Okay.
One is Krishna, he acted as a kshatriya and in his daily activities in Dwarka, after getting up he used to chant Gayatri Mantra.
There you go.
That was second is from the Buddha Gita. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 27th chapter of the 11th canto, Lord Krishna's instruction on the process of deity worship. So then the purport is mentioned that members of the Brahmana, Kshatriya and Vaishya communities all achieve Dvijatvam, twice born status, by initiation into the Gayatri Mantra.
There you go. Okay. All right. Good word. Good word.
Cast down
his head and so therefore it is we must be just taking it in terms of by birth in that purport there, you know, that Prabhupada is mentioning. Alright then. Yes, keep looking at the deities, Nirmala, but if you develop any adverse side effects, you'd let us know. That'll be 11th canto.
Oh, yeah.
But,